And the word joy has different connotations for all of us. You know, at its surface, it can imagine someone skipping through life joyful, everything's great. But I think joy, you know, for me is a deeper emotion. And there is joy in helping someone die in the way they wish and with the peace and harmony around them that they desire. There's joy in taking care of a patient with a horrendous case of, you know, vascular disease who has chronic ischemia and pain, and you're helping them alleviate their symptoms. There's still joy in that. And I think that the joy we take in being physicians is both being there in good health and in sickness, and in knowing that we, in some small way, helped or alleviated a pain or helped a patient achieve their own goals.
Welcome to Flourishing in Medicine from Surviving to Thriving. I'm Mick Krasner, your host, and this podcast is produced by MPRO, a medical professional liability insurance carrier headquartered in New York State, committed through a number of peer support offerings to supporting the physicians they protect. The title of today's podcast is Navigating the Burdens of Medical Practice, A Journey Towards Systemic Change, a conversation with Dr. Jane Fogg of the American Medical Association. Jane is a physician leader and executive with broad experience leading healthcare delivery, focusing on primary care, systems redesign, and value-based delivery models, and a senior physician advisor for the Division of Professional Satisfaction and Practice Sustainability at the American Medical Association. Prior to this, she was the executive chair of internal medicine and family medicine at Atrius Health, an innovative value-based healthcare leader in Massachusetts, and a member of Optum, responsible for the care delivery and outcomes of a practice with 350 physicians and advanced practice clinicians caring for over 400,000 patients. During this conversation, Dr. Fogg reflects on her over three decades career, where she's grown increasingly aware of systemic deficiencies in the organization of healthcare, especially in primary care, which have fueled her commitment to addressing these issues in her many leadership roles. While grappling with physician burnout and systemic challenges, Dr. Fogg advocates for fundamental changes in healthcare delivery, in particular, promoting and implementing value-based care, which aligns financial incentives with quality patient care. She emphasizes quite persuasively that the transition to value-based care and data-driven decision-making while optimizing clinical operations can enhance physician well-being as well as practice efficiency. She shares with us actionable strategies such as in-basket workload reduction while championing honesty, gratitude, and joy in healthcare practice and leadership. Her authenticity, deep commitment to not only patients but to her colleagues, whom she describes as equally committed, resilient, and inspirational, has given her the motivation and energy to make really tough changes in helping physicians and other health professionals flourish. And now, my conversation with Dr. Jane Fogg. So welcome, Dr. Fogg, to Flourishing in Medicine from Surviving to Thriving. We're really thrilled to have you, especially because of your work in very practical ways of bringing interventions and thinking about creative ways to unburden some of the things that especially primary care physicians experience, but physicians in general. What I'd like to start with is how I often will start many of these conversations is I'd like to hear a little bit about, you know, why medicine for you? What was the formative things in your life that you're willing to share that happened that brought you to this point? Sometimes, you know, these are common stories of experiences that we have at a young age in our families, but they also may be formative things that happened during the process of your education, the choices you made along the way. So I'd love to hear about that background so we kind of get a sense of who's in the room here with us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's really a pleasure to share what I've learned over my three decades journey. I did not know that I would be a doctor. I had no plan for this. I loved math. I loved science, but I loved a lot of things. Somewhere in college, someone suggested I might think of medical school. And I thought, wow, that's funny. But I thought about it. There's no one in my family in healthcare. And so I had no preconceived notions about what doctoring might be. I decided to explore what it might mean. And I did some research. I dissected cow eyeballs and had a good time doing that, but realized it really wasn't teaching me about what it really means to take care of patients. So then I took a job as sort of a medical assistant at an organization called Harvard Community Health Plan, which is where I eventually ended up working. And I worked in the oncology group and I answered phones and I put patients in rooms and I coordinated things for the doctors. A couple months in, I thought, absolutely not. These guys work so hard. This is so hard. And then the next couple of months, I thought, well, yeah, this is what I want to do. And so I feel like I was really fortunate to see what it actually means to take care of a patient, especially a patient with a really complex illness, as we did in oncology. And that helped propel me to do what I needed to do to apply to medical school. So I remember when I told my parents that I was going to apply to medical school, I think my mother sat there in silent shock and awe. And my father said, and I will never forget, but will you have time to smell the roses? And he said that because many of his friends were doctors and he saw how hard they worked and how many family events, personal events they missed. And he had that impression. And he was not in medicine. At my young age, I thought, what a weird, of course I'm going to smell roses. But when I reflect on that now, he had a really good point. Many doctors are not smelling the roses. And so perhaps that was an early push in the direction that I ultimately ended.
So I'm really curious about what you said about working with those patients, placing them in rooms and kind of assisting and supporting the care that was being given in this oncology office where you functioned as a medical assistant. There must have been something about that really drew you in to illness, to complexity. And also, even though it may have sounded weird at the same time, what your father had said, was there already at least a nascent commitment to taking care of yourself as well, smelling the roses, so to speak?
Yeah. I think, one of the things I learned about being a medical assistant is that the patient will tell you something entirely different than they will tell the doctor. And that's not a bad thing. When I was in the room with a patient, they would tell me how awful things were and what was wrong and their grievances. And the doctor would walk in and they had a big smile. And there was just that bond, that relationship that develops in any of our disciplines where there's continuity, certainly primary care, but oncology, absolutely, many of our specialties, where you know someone over time during complex illness, the way the patient would light up when their doctor came in, no matter how poorly they felt. And I think that's kind of what got me the most, because I really enjoy being with people. And I saw that kind of relationship was something that held immense value and was earned by the physicians and the way that they cared for their patients and the way their teams cared for them. I also thought the science was really interesting. So cancer is difficult and complicated. At the time that I worked there, we were just beginning to see HIV and we had little understanding and we did some of the care in the office. So I also was witness to an emerging epidemic that was scary and challenging, and many were not engaged in taking care of patients who were suffering. So it was a strong pull about what it means to be a caregiver and what it means to be trusted to take care of you. So I think that perhaps is the biggest reason, even though the science was really interesting, I knew that I was headed towards whatever I did in medicine. It would involve longitudinal relationships.
Yeah, it seems really clear from your story that relationship is really at the center of it. I'm also thinking some of the things that were coming up for me as you were discussing this was a mutuality, that it's not all one-sided, that in some ways that smile that the patient put on was in a way taking care of the person who was caring for them, that there's some need to make sure that person's okay as well. You said a little bit about the primary care, and that became a big part of your career path, but also movement into leadership and also this interest in systems redesign. What was the awareness and the consciousness around wanting to improve, things that you were seeing that just didn't sit right with you, perhaps?
I also did not know I would end up in leadership. If you asked me as an intern resident, even my first year out of residency and my first job, I joined as a full-time PCP. And I think in your earlier, you asked if I had an inkling that I'd be thinking about that balance, that work-life balance, that self-care. I think actually I channeled the first 30 years to caring for other physicians and caring for the system, you know, caring for the construct in which we all work, not as much as caring for myself. It took me a ways to get there to take that time. So I was fortunate to go to a medical school that exposed me. I was in Northern Manhattan. I was at Columbia, and I had amazing teachers and clinical experiences working in places like Harlem Hospital, where I saw what really happens when a community doesn't have access to excellent and continuous care. There was little continuity in the primary care delivered. Much of it was episodic. And I returned to Boston for residency, kind of knowing it would be good to be near a family because it's a really challenging time. I think in those training years, you kind of go into your bubble and you work hard, and I don't remember much of those 7 years beyond that. But again, I had a great mentor who saw who I was and what I was good at and where I might land, and encouraged me to continue into primary care at a time where out of, I think, 30 of us, four of us went into primary care. And even one faculty said to me, "I was so sorry to hear that you're going to primary care. You're so smart." And I thought, the smartest people I've met in my training are these internal medicine — we didn't have family medicine in our group — these internal medicine physicians, because they take care of these complex presentations that involve humans and symptoms and lab tests, and they try to figure out which way to go. That's hard. So I was a little miffed, and maybe put a little chip on my shoulder that primary care was something I needed to pay attention to, because it was not professionally at the, you know, we didn't, it wasn't at the top of the hierarchy, and I thought it should be. So I took a job in a community health center. And I think it was hearkening back to my medical school experience. I wanted to be in a community that didn't have access to great care all the time. And I was really lucky. My first 8 years, I joined what's now called the Dimmock Center in Roxbury, Massachusetts. And again, was really fortunate to work with some highly skilled, compassionate, amazing physicians. And we called it the adult medicine department. I didn't know how hard it would be. My first week of work, they told me that I was, we rounded on our patients in the hospital. They did not have hospitalists. We took care of our patients. I saw 20 patients my first day of work. And then they told me that I was rounding in our on-site detox center 2 days a week. So I didn't realize that in the job description, but I, you know, as part of the group of internal medicine docs, we took care of our on-site detox center. We rounded on patients. We prescribed medications. I was suddenly doing healthcare that I had partial preparation for and really had to learn from my mentors and colleagues. And I absolutely adored it. And I loved that community. I felt like it brought forward in me values that I didn't know I had about the importance of community, the importance of respect, and meeting people where they're at. And I just feel incredibly lucky to have started in that direction. But after the first year, the medical director came to me and he said, "Jane, the director of adult medicine is stepping down to pursue other things. Could you fill in for a few months while we find someone real, an adult?" As I was 1 year out, and I said, "Sure, I'll do that. I'm an organizer." And I never left. And I was the director of adult medicine for the next 7 years. And I learned from mistakes. I learned from some success. I learned from some mentoring from my colleagues there. But yeah, I made mistakes. And I didn't have any preparation in leadership. But I did know that I got immense joy by fixing problems, by fixing the obstacles that stood in the way of our care teams taking care of patients and our patients, whether it was the on-call system, the phones, the fax machine never had paper, you know, basic things sometimes. But I really enjoyed trying to set things right, so to speak. And so that's really what started my path to leadership. I really fell right into it.
Yeah. So 30 years of taking care of others, your colleagues, seeing these problems arise, You know, you've named a few of those things. Maybe you can speak a little bit more about some of the things that you were experiencing in the primary care practice that raised concerns for the need for systemic change. Maybe including some of the things that are still problematic and maybe have become more prominent now because medicine, of course, has changed so much in that 30-year period.
There has been a constant evolution in my career, not in the right direction in primary care, sadly. And I actually thought back, you know, in my first job, in 20 years, we're going to see fundamental change in this country. We're going to figure out that what we have in the American healthcare system is not adequate and we're going to fix it. I was a little naive. We're not there yet. You know, in my first role in a community health center, I saw how things are strung together with Band-Aids, how there were programs designed to support specific patients, whether you were pregnant or had a certain condition. But then if you were a 32-year-old man who didn't have those conditions, you did not have that kind of insurance support or access to care. It seemed fundamentally wrong to have a Band-Aid at every juncture to try to care for people. I moved in my next job to an academic medical center, turned where I had trained, and my goal was to, with, I thought, a sort of a richer resources environment, that I'd be able to really make a practice sing, I'd be able to make patient care accessible and great, and I learned so much in my community health center experience. I got there, I started a practice, I grew up from nothing to about 10,000 or more patients and multiple PCPs and some APPs. And in those 12 years, value-based care came into our organization. We also, what I saw in the primary care sphere was that it was just getting harder and harder to care for patients. And I started to see colleagues burn out. I saw some of my colleagues left for concierge medicine, which, you know, they were all quite happy with and said, it's just a joy to take care of a smaller panel of patients. I can spend time with them. I feel like I do a good job. And that was, it was not uncommon in our practice to see that happen. And that distressed me because fundamentally, I believe that money shouldn't dictate your access to care, and especially primary care. So that was a real tension that I felt and paid attention to. I also had a colleague who was a wonderful physician. She took such great care of people, and I watched her burn out and leave. And she was my age. And I think that's where I got the spark to dig into the systemic causes. I did not see ever that burnout was the result of lack of strength or will, or just don't want to work that hard. Every physician I've had the privilege to work with and every physician that I've been the leader of, I have seen people work hard and enjoy complexity, enjoy challenging patient situations. Like, we go into this because we like that. But the frustrations of practice, the obstacles before you, the difficulty trusting that your patient can navigate through the system successfully, whether it's to specialty, hospital, post-acute care, behavioral health, you as a PCP, you see the cracks in the system, you see your patient's journey, and it becomes immensely frustrating and you can't help them the way you want to. And there's more pressure to go faster, see more patients, do more. When I think about doing a physical exam in 1996, I sat down one day and I tried to remember, like, what were all the things we did that were our standard sort of set of preventative measures, vaccines. And then I did it for 2019 and I was just blown away. And the physical exam time, has it doubled? No. Doctors are still doing physical exams in about the same amount of time they did back in the 90s, but they're doing 3 to 4 times more. And it's just, so it takes away from the best part of the physical exam, which is the, how are you? What's going on? How's your family? How are you doing? You know, you don't have as much time to talk because you got to get all these little things done. So that's where seeing those systemic problems and working in an academic medical center, I poked my head up and I put my hand up and tried to get some jobs leading systemic change. And I was fortunate to do that. We had an arm of the organization that did the contracting for value-based care and for any of our commercial and public contracts. And they gave me some time to be the medical director of primary care, which was really translating value-based care into practice. What does it actually mean to do it? What does it mean to achieve quality, reduce cost, improve experience? At the same time, I also took on a job for our primary care community group, which was about 180 doctors, maybe at that point, working on practice redesign. How do you redesign primary care to be patient-centered, effective, and bring joy back to physicians? So I had those two arms going at the same time while being a PCP, while running my practice, and had some successes and then saw, you know, also had some challenges, how we call them. But that was really what got me started on this journey to fix the systemic problems that still plague us today.
Yes, we're going to come back to both value-based care and this practice redesign, but I wanted to take just a little sidetrack, which I think would be is worthwhile. You mentioned something about, you know, we like complexity, and I was a primary care internist as well, and there's something joyful about it. And also the truth that it's not a deficiency we have, that burnout is happening. It's not because of some flaw that their medical schools are just choosing the wrong people. Not at all. It's a very complex system that we work in. You're now a senior physician advisor for the Division of Professional Satisfaction and Practice Sustainability. It's a mouthful, for the American Medical Association. And I want to offer you a quote. This is a quote from Joseph Campbell. You may know the great mythologist Joseph Campbell. And here's what he said, and then I have a question. So he said, "Participate joyfully in the sorrows of the world. We cannot cure the world of sorrows, but we can choose to live in joy. The warrior's approach is to say yes to life, yes to it all." So based on kind of that, how do you hold or understand or frame joy in medicine for our colleagues and for yourself?
Thank you for that question, because I think about words, because my mother read poetry to me as a child. So I'm often thinking about how we use words. And the word joy has different connotations for all of us. You know, at its surface, it can imagine someone skipping through life, joyful, everything's great. But I think joy, you know, for me is a deeper emotion. And there is joy in helping someone die in the way they wish and with the peace and harmony around them that they desire. There's joy in taking care of a patient with a horrendous case of, you know, vascular disease, who has chronic ischemia and pain, and you're helping them alleviate their symptoms. There's still joy in that. And I think that the joy we take in being physicians is both being there in good health and in sickness, and in knowing that we in some small way helped or alleviated a pain or helped a patient achieve their own goals. And so that's a little different than skipping through life, because sometimes you're holding someone's hand at the last visit before they die. But I think that that's what we get joy from. And it has been diminished when you have to walk out of that exam room, as I once did when my patient told me, "It's time for me to stop chemo. I'm done. And I want to go to hospice, and I want to be in a hospice home." And I had to scramble to find the hospice home and get them in. If you have a really well working system and a great team, a nurse around the corner says, "I got this. I'm on the phone. I'm going to go figure out how to get them. You just stay with your patient and have that conversation." But today, too often, the nurse is scrambling, the doctor's scrambling. We're all having a hard time getting what our patients need. And that's where joy gets robbed.
Yeah, I think you've named some really important things. One is this, you could call it eudaimonia, the deep joy and satisfaction of something that could actually be very, very challenging. You know, there was a study many, many years ago of a group of internists and what they found most meaningful in their work. And they wrote these narratives about their experiences. And they were not the great triumphs of biomedicine. They were stories that were really difficult and really challenging, often involving loss. But it was the relational aspects, the presence that one offers, the bit of relief of the suffering and being engaged and being there versus this moral distress, which is kind of what you're pointing to in knowing what the solutions are, but they're not there, or they're not easily there, or there are so many systemic barriers to make them happen that take up so much of our cognitive load and time and energies that it takes away from our ability to really have that eudaimonic sense of satisfaction. So I appreciate you naming that. Back to value-based care and practice redesign. Can you talk a little bit about the theory and implementation of value-based care, the effects that it's happened on transforming systems within healthcare and in our lives and how we actually do our work? What are some of the potentials? How's it played out thus far? What can we expect going forward? I think it's the right course, but it's a challenging course because it is quite a shift for so many of us and has been over the last two decades.
I've been fortunate to work for organizations that are deeply based in value and can make it work. So I've had that experience of both fee-for-service, which I'll describe, and value. And I think I've seen what it really takes to make value work. Most physicians in this country under a fee-for-service model in which they're paid for each event or visit or procedure or surgery that they do, and not for the outcome of said event, surgery, visit. In value-based care, which is a broad term, so there's many different shades of value, you're rewarded for delivering value, whether that might be improving quality, reducing unnecessary costs, improving patient experience, and so on. And certainly we often talk about it in a financial realm where you're not being paid to go faster, you're being paid to deliver great care and be measured on those outcomes. But I always say it's gray. It's not a black and white, one system or the others, different ways to deliver value. But at its core, I think the thing that relates primary care, professional satisfaction, and value is that there's a real alignment and mission. Again, I don't know many doctors, I've come across very few, who get joy out of going really fast, seeing a lot of patients, and having their compensation based on that. I think the joy comes in caring for patients, of taking care of them, of having a great surgical outcome for a patient, or helping them through a cancer diagnosis and into remission. And so we want our patients to be well. We want to have them achieve what they need, and to marry the financial model to that feels a little bit more aligned. Let me work on taking good care of you. I think we also do, you know, we're data-driven in medicine. That's how we're trained. And in value-based care, you need to be data-driven. You can't just think you're giving value. You have to measure and know. And there's a lot of complexity in that. It's not as easy as it sounds. And with such a fractured healthcare environment across the country, meaning we're not in one universal system, each system might be doing it slightly differently. So it's immensely complicated. I think a value-based care also stresses the system, not just the physician, but their practice or their health delivery system that they work for, to be really well run, meaning you close care gaps. If patient needs a referral to specialty X, you get them there, and you get them there efficiently and effectively. If the patient is discharged from an outside hospital, you immediately know, and you're part of coordinating that care and reducing any readmission that could have been prevented. You're meeting patients in the home and treating them at home, even home hospital. I mean, you really have to work well as an organization in a reliable, high quality, safe, and effective way. So it stresses the practice to do that. It's not just the doctor by themselves saying, I'm going to give value today. I'm going to be a really good doc. I think it also brings some honesty into the conversation. There's been a lot of great work from many others in my time identifying what good quality care is, and certainly identifying low value care, and campaigns like Choosing Wisely and others, which been sort of part of my practice growing up, point out when we physicians have not brought evidence-based medicine into practice as quickly as we should. And we might be, say, doing an MRI of someone's back when they've had pain for a week or two and there's no red flags, you know, things like that, learning to say, actually, that's not evidence-based effective care. And we should identify when we can, that low-value care, and make an agreement not to do it. So it's very much aligned with professional values, I think. It is slower to spread. I mean, for decades I've had, you know, I can't pick up a paper or blog without someone saying value-based care is coming. But in my last job at Atrius Health, a very value-based care organization, the challenge wasn't our desire to do value. The challenge was the environment, was the insurance offerings, the employer offerings that were not choosing risk, that were choosing something more predictable. And that You know, I wonder a bit, are we really on a journey to value or not? I hope so, but I don't think it's spread as fast as we like to write about.
Well, thank you. You know, one of the things you mentioned was it takes the practice or team or collaborative care models, really. So that's a key ingredient of the value-based care. And maybe if we can just magnify that or hone in on that, you know, what are some of the challenges in developing these collaborative care models? And some of it is the collaboration with having the insurance payers get on board with how we're going to incent that as well. You just named that. But what are some of these challenges in forming these teams in your practice, in your community of practices, in your healthcare system that you're working within, as well as the potential in terms of one particular thing, particular to this podcast, which is what can they offer us in terms of well-being and satisfaction? I mean, you've named it in a broad way. Are there other ways of looking at that team-based collaborative care model as something that really could support our well-being as physicians and other health professionals?
I think if you design value-based care in systems intentionally, mindfully, thinking about well-being, you'll find that what you're building for value can actually support well-being. But I think it's important to think about what those elements are. You know, teaming is, again, it's another word that's used broadly. So what do I mean by teaming? First and foremost, I think that medicine is a social sport. We enjoy not just our patients, but we enjoy each other. And for any physicians listening, if you've ever had that experience where you're working with a nurse, a medical assistant, a nurse practitioner, somebody really having a really tight, high-functioning team experience, it's awesome. It's great because at the end of the day, there's no way to make medicine predictable. You might think you're walking into a relatively straightforward day and you get three curveballs thrown at you, people who need to see you, who have compelling needs, and you've got to deal with it and you don't want to be late for everyone else. And, you know, that first nucleus of team, which I think is your practice team and can be shaped in different ways, but those are the people that say, hey, Dr. Fogg, I really need you to see this patient. She's having a really bad asthma flare. You know her well. Give me your prescriptions. I'll go do those while you see her. Or let me take that phone call and see if I can triage it for you while you go see that patient. I experienced that in my practice in Needham that I started. We went from a very sort of fee-for-service model to value and from a very undesigned to redesigned model. And that I felt like practice was singing was when there was so much communication between my secretary, medical assistant, nurse, my partnering nurse practitioner who shared my panel with me, the practice manager, my colleagues. We were just all oriented around giving great care and helping each other do it. So that's teamwork. And a lot of docs, unfortunately, don't have the opportunity to work with the same medical assistant or the same nurse, don't get to develop that relationship where you can really be helpful to each other. And unfortunately, results in things like sending a message that says, patient called with a cough and fever, please advise, which is very different than I called the patient back, I got more detail, I think they need to see you, I got them into your schedule. That's a different message. So teaming starts, there's a nucleus of it that for every physician, whether you're primary care, surgical, gastroenterology, we all do better when we have a stable, reliable, strong team. And then I think they're the next shell that I think of is, I think the practice is a team. You know, the system I was in charge, I was the chair of internal medicine and family medicine for a service line. And for me, that next ring around the team was social services support, behavioral health, access to specialties, our urgent care team, our on-call team, our clinical pharmacists, all that broader team, population health managers who helped care for those panel of patients by being available 24/7, by being accessible, by when you identify a health-related social need, having someone who can come help. When you identify really sort of severe depression that is getting worse and you need more guidance as a PCP, having somebody who can jump in. So I think that kind of functioning, that larger shell is also part of teaming to me. And then I think, you know, organizations need to team. We are all in different relationships. I practiced in Boston and we're 14 hospitals that we worked with. And how, you know, when your patients are going between a colonoscopy at a hospital and the practice or an admission and then a post-acute facility and then back to my practice, that's a lot of teaming that needs to happen to make sure we do it well. So teaming is, I think, one of the highest ideals, but I think there's a lot of layers, and the challenge is having people in positions reliably. So you develop relationships. There's been so much turnover. We have struggles with nursing, medical assistant, all kinds of staff members. And it's very hard for folks. I was a medical assistant once to walk in and get trained up in a day. It takes some time. And so it's a very challenging role. And I think that that's been one of the hardest things that I've seen in the last couple of years, is teaming being affected by staffing shortages.
You know, you've talked about and written about this, trying to incorporate teaming and the other aspects of value-based care and system redesign in medicine. My question is about, what are some educational pieces that could be helpful in moving this transition along? I'm thinking of undergraduate and residency education efforts, because in some ways they live somewhat protected from this, yet these are core, what you're describing are core competencies to deliver healthcare as a health professional, as a physician in particular. And if we're not getting them and seeing them in our environment, in that educational part of our journey, that earlier part of our training, how do we move into them? And how can this be moved along as each new cohort is coming in? And it's like they're completely confused as to how this works.
It's very important that it starts in medical education. There was a paper written years ago, maybe 20, I think it was Tom Lee, who talked about the fact that physicians of the future need to know how to be team leaders, and we're not training them to be team leaders. And that, you know, there wasn't anything in my medical school training or residency about being a leader, but if I were designing a curriculum now, I would actually have some courses on what does it mean to be part of a team? What does it mean to be a leader of a team? And pragmatic examples, you know, are you exposed to a PCP meeting with their team to talk about doing a huddle in the morning to look at who they're going to see with their team and prepare quickly in 5 to 8 minutes how they're going to care for patients as a team? Do they see, what does it mean when a medical assistant is struggling to take a blood pressure and you're pretty sure it's not accurate? How do you give and give feedback in a constructive manner? Do we teach doctors to do that? And unfortunately, we don't. And so what I sometimes see is some docs get frustrated and they say to the manager, just train that MA on how to give a blood pressure. I don't have time. And if you snap at people as a doc, I've always learned they don't want to help you as much if you're somebody who's irritable and snapping. But it's also really hard to keep seeing a lot of patients and then stop and teach someone how to take a blood pressure. So It takes all of us to work together to improve the functioning of a team. And I hope that medical schools and residency curriculums would think about how to invite a conversation about teaming, under talk about psychological safety. How do we offer that to our team members so that they're willing to speak up? Because maybe they saw a problem coming, but they were afraid to tell you. How do we teach psychological safety and the value of that? So I think it should start earlier, absolutely. And I think the next generation of doctors is going to face having to work with larger teams, and many of them will be working in larger institutions. As so much acquisition has happened, many of them, their first jobs will be in, would have been working for me in my last job at a large healthcare delivery organization, where suddenly you're one of 200 doctors at 21 sites and there's 100 APPs and you're in a big place. And what do we need to do to help you be successful in that and still have your agency and your engagement? Because it's a big transition from residency.
Yeah, yes, it really is. I want to, a related question, I wanted to set this up a little bit, that physicians and other health professionals are indeed looking for actionable items that we can do now that to enhance well-being now. And the pace, unfortunately, of systemic changes that needs to happen seems to be glacial at best. Here on this program, we've interviewed colleagues who work in small and large teams, people that work in peer support programs, educational experts working on the antecedents of burnout at the undergraduate residency levels, cognitive scientists looking at ways we can use technology and self-awareness to improve quality of care and patient and professional satisfaction. You've shared some really intriguing interventions that address systems directly and that are actionable. I'm thinking of the in-basket reduction initiatives. I think our listeners would really love to hear about this. Can you tell us a little bit about that, how that works, and what are some easy steps? I've read some of your work and it outlines some things that we can actually do now that could help us in managing our in-baskets, which is a big part of our work life, and maybe some other resources that are available for folks.
One great resource that is available to everybody without having to join is AMA has a huge compendium of what's called Steps Forward podcasts, Steps Forward toolkits, playbooks, and it's all on the AMA website under Steps Forward. And if you feel a little lost at first, just look up the playbooks and start there. The playbooks are a combination of multiple different toolkits, all aimed at offering both examples of best practices as well, you know, and compiling sort of evidence from across the spectrum. So a playbook, there's a saving time playbook, there's a reducing the EHR in basket playbook, there's a leadership aimed at wellness playbook. So a variety of resources that really flesh this out. I think as I've recently joined the organization, and it's been a pleasure for me to sort of take those 30 years of leadership and trying to fix as the person in charge, trying to fix things, and now trying to turn across the nation and both learn from other groups, but also offer my experiences and what I've been able to do or hope to do to others. So that's a great place to start. I'm someone who always categorizes why I'm a PCP. I look at you, you tell me 26 things, and I'm immediately block and tackling and trying to figure out how to organize it. But when I think about solutions to physician well-being for every discipline, I think there's sort of, I break it down to 5 categories. Certainly leadership is one, which we can talk about. A culture of wellness in the practice is another. But then I think there's 3 sort of systems categories. And I think that our challenges in burnout in this country are mainly due to the systems. And that's where we need to start. So the first system is teaming, and we've talked a little bit about that. Another system is not just the in-basket, but the EHR, clinical technology. There's a lot we can do across the EHR spectrum. And my third system is just the clinical operations, the sort of sophistication of the organization, meaning do you have central services that support patient care needs? Do you have great access for urgent care? Do you have on-call 24/7? Those kind of things. I did a lot of work in EHR as one of the systems. It came about when I was at Atrius Health. In my first year there, the organization made a decision to invest some resources and time in looking at the burdens that EHRs place on primary care. And as the chair of internal medicine and family medicine, I had the opportunity to sit down and think, what can we do in this year that will improve the EHR usability and reduce the work burden for my PCPs and their teams? And there were a lot of things we looked at. There were certainly some optimizations we made, improving the way certain things get documented and such, but we could not ignore. It was blaringly obvious without a survey that the in-basket was one of the biggest problems. The in-basket for a PCP, I like to call it, it's not your doctor's email, but sometimes people think it is. You saw this, Dr. Fogg will get that. But when we started, we had 100 messages per business day, 500 messages per week for a full-time PCP. When we looked at all those messages, many of them were things that a doctor doesn't need to see. But the default has been in EHR design and in system design, just route to the PCP so they can check it, we'll all feel better, and then off it goes. And unfortunately, with so much interoperability, which I fought for for years earlier, there's way too much information coming at PCPs. And so you look at your 100 messages and there may be 4 to 5 that absolutely are critical and you need to deal with right now, and they're buried. And so we read the content of all these messages to get an understanding, and we came back with there's high variation in message. There isn't an intentional sort of system to figure out what goes where. And there isn't a single solution. I mean, it would have been a really great solution if I could have hired a nurse for every PCP. I would have gladly done it and allowed them to manage the in-basket, but it wasn't fiscally appropriate nor feasible in terms of finding that many nurses. So I developed a framework with our team to help center us on what we can do, because we're going to have to pick at this problem bit by bit. And the framework was looking at what can we eliminate completely, remove it? What can we use automation for? Where can we delegate within the EHR, meaning force the delegation? Don't make the doctor do it, but send it right to that person who should do it. And where should we collaborate on that in basket? And that kind of centered us a little bit. It helped us figure out that this was going to be a journey, a multi-year journey, and that it was going to be a combination of clinical, operational, and technical expertise. And I kudos to my team there, because it was an absolutely fantastic group. Working really closely with the CMIO's team, I think that partnership made us advance more than I think we even thought we could. When we looked at things like Eliminate, and these are all available. I wrote a paper that's in the Catalyst and outlines a lot of the details, but there are many things you can suppress from going to a PCP's in-basket or a specialist in-basket simply by grabbing a governance group, looking what the content is, and working with your IT team. We did some pragmatic things like not sending every CC chart, which is sort of a FYI, here's a letter, I saw your patient, they had a normal skin check. We made a decision not to send all those to PCPs unless there was a clinical value, which could be a new diagnosis, change in prognosis, or something you need me to do. We looked at all the things that were scanned documents, and they go into this folder called Media Manager, and we recategorized and filed many of them silently. Insurance forms, why does that go to the doctor? So we did a lot of silent filing, and we got a 98% reduction in that folder. We looked at the notifications that come in from hospitals, and we very much care about our patients being hospitalized and being ready for them to coordinate care, but we were getting 6 messages per hospitalization, and many were blank. They were sort of without content, no discharge summary. So we pulled them out of the in-basket and put them into a dashboard that doctors could pull at will and see who was in the hospital and who was coming home. So those were some, and there are other alerts. I've learned that some organizations across the country will send their doctors a notice every single time a patient doesn't show up for an appointment or something scheduled. You can suppress a lot of that. And I think that kind of work, looking for ways that you can suppress and asking yourself, what is the purpose of sending it to Dr. X? What is the expected outcome of that? Is a great way to start and get a good chunk of messages reduced or removed. We were also very lucky. I mean, Atrius Health is a very nimble and technologically interested organization. And so when we moved to automation, I had the privilege of working with another great team where we automated prescription renewals that were routine and that had passed certain checkpoints, meaning quality and appointments and such were checked and were there. And we did this all through an automation platform and with delegation protocols. So 50% of the prescription renewals were removed from my PCP in baskets. And we did this similar work with normal labs, which were labs that are normal in every situation. And those types of things, and there are other things. Today's PCPs and many others are most plagued by unfiltered messages coming from patients to them. It's great that patients can email their doctor, but if the message should have been dealt with by a secretary or a medical assistant or nurse, it should go there first. Unfortunately, many doctors receive all messages and then they send it on. And it's kind of similar to if we said, well, why don't we have the doctor answer the phone for the office and then go find a medical assistant to fill out the form. So we should reverse the delegation. And many across the country are doing good work in this regard, having it filtered by the right people who can resolve much of it. We piloted it in some areas and found that we had a 45% reduction off the bat, which is, and there was more to go. But it just shows you that if you really look at how you can retune your EHR routing, and it doesn't take, you know, it's not a huge project like automation, I think you can make some pragmatic steps forward. And I think it's a very common need across the country.
That is very practical, very helpful. We will definitely include both the article from the NEJM Catalyst that you wrote, as well as the links to the American Medical Association steps forward and toolkits and playbooks, because I think those could be really useful to our listeners. We're going to come to a close shortly. I was really touched in a certain way when you described singing. Your team was singing. And I think that's kind of the way I've experienced it as well. There's sort of like you're an ensemble playing music. It's jazz because it's improvised in a certain way. There's uncertainties involved, of course, but everyone has a voice and the voices are different. The sounds of the tones are different, to use a metaphor. Another metaphor I'd like to offer and then just hear from you as we come to a close. I think I wasn't even planning on this, but you know, I'd mentioned Joseph Campbell. There was an anthropologist named Angelus Arien. She worked in cultural anthropology and she looked at healing systems across multiple indigenous cultures. And she came up with a formulation of what is it that a healer would ask someone in need of healing? What are four questions, if she could distill all of her studies of indigenous cultures and the healing communities within those cultures? And they were the following four. The first was, when was the last time you sang? When was the last time you sang? Second was, when was the last time you danced? When was the last time you danced? The third was, when was the last time you were enchanted by story? When was the last time you were enchanted by story? And then finally, the fourth one was, when was the last time you entered into the sweet silence? And I'm thinking in terms of us, physicians, health professionals in need of some kind of healing to help us heal others, that can provide a roadmap. You know, if you are moving towards systems that and teams that are working together where you're actually singing and dancing literally or metaphorically, and that you're sharing with each other stories, and you're able to stay present to the unspeakables that we encounter every day in our practice lives, that would seem to me to be kind of something that is moving in the direction of healing. And maybe you could just share any thoughts that just come up as you listen to what I just shared. And, you know, what do we need to learn to get there? What are maybe the top two or three things that you think that could help us move this along in a healthy direction for the benefit of not just health professionals and physicians, but ultimately our patients, because that's what we're centered on.
My first reaction is, I wonder if I did a retreat many years ago called Courage to Lead that was run by the Center for Courage and Renewal. And it came at a time in my life that I didn't know I needed it. And it really reset me. And this was a series of weekend retreats run by some amazing facilitators where we read poetry and responded to it and worked in small group or in larger group discussion and used that poetry as sort of a vehicle for more reflection. And I was a little bit younger than some of the others. Ours was designed around healthcare leaders. Perhaps everyone there was about 10 years ahead of me in their leadership journey. And I saw the rawness of broken leaders, of people who had fantastically successful careers, but were really drowning on the inside and really questioning where they were and where they were at. And the purpose of this retreat in my mind was ultimately to help us find our true self. What do we want to bring to our leadership and our lives? And I still have my journals and I sometimes read them when I kind of need to remember who I am and where I'm at. And it struck me that I wrote 15 years ago that I got immense joy out of helping physicians and teams find a way to effectively care for their patients in a system that felt supportive and not obstructive. So the gem had started back there, but I think I made a real commitment to integrity, honesty, courage, to be the kind of leader that leads with her light and not her shadow. And to bring that, even though times are going to be hard, and they certainly have been over the last couple decades, and certainly through the pandemic, caring for a battered workforce and a terrified community, to bring that level of honesty there. And so I had some affirmations from my last practice that my style of leadership, of inviting difficult questions, of engaging in hard conversations, of being willing to be honest about the tensions that exist in our work, finance versus autonomy, all those tensions, that simply that honesty was a gift. And also, you know, when I question, well, why do I do this? The system doesn't work. I can't help people. I think what brought me back was that, well, I think I have decent judgment. I don't have the best judgment in the world, but I think I have decent judgment and I certainly care a lot. So I'm willing to stay in as the leader in hard times because I want to bring that. I want to have somebody in that seat that really cares and practices good judgment. And so when I think of sort of singing and dancing, I think of Penny Williamson, who was ran my group, who taught me the value of dancing. And I've had moments where I'm not a good singer, but I've sung in my car or I've danced in my kitchen. And they're just moments when I feel like something really went right today, or somebody said something to me to make me realize I made a difference and I didn't know I was. And I think we all need to give that to each other. We give it to our patients, but we also need to give it to each other. We need to turn to the nurse and the medical assistant and to our fellow gastroenterologist and to the hospitalist and all the people that are part of our medical community and give those affirmations and say, thank you, I noticed you did that. That was amazing. When people do that for each other, it does bring some joy back. Yeah, I'd like to change the American healthcare system. Absolutely. That'll take a 5-hour podcast. But, you know, what can you do today and now is show gratitude and respect for those around you who are working hard to do this. And if you snap at someone, come around later and say, I'm so sorry. I was irritable because I'm worried I'm going to miss getting to pick my child up at school. Just be honest. But those kinds of values, I think, can bring us back to perhaps a more, dare I say, joyful time, even though we are not going to fix the ills of healthcare. And if we can bring that to our practice and to our community, I think we can all advance us a little more. I would say lastly that I hope for courage of our country to think more creatively and more boldly about healthcare reform. I don't think a series of band-aids is going to get us what we want. We are an incredibly smart and wealthy nation, and we have pretty poor marks when you compare us against other economically developed nations. And we're not going to be better if we just keep slapping band-aids on. So I encourage people to read and educate themselves and form their opinions, but really be courageous, because I think it's going to take that for us to have great health for our nation and a joyful place to work for all those who care for patients.
Well, what a wonderful way to conclude this, and that has been such a delightful, delightful conversation. Thank you so much, Jane. Thanks for listening today. We will include a summary of the podcast with links about Dr. Fogg and other references that were made during our discussion in the show notes. I'd like to conclude by sharing yet another practical exercise to help you flourish. This practice can be done at the workplace, or actually in any place where others are working. The objective is to be aware of what Dr. Fogg described as taming. So sometime this week, if you could, please take the time to simply pause for anywhere between 1 and 3 minutes at a workstation, at your work, in your office with the door open, in a hospital ward location, in the clinic. It can be a clinical setting or not. It could be in any place that you happen to be where others are working together. And as you stop and take that pause, simply bring awareness to the sounds of what's going on. Sounds of people talking to each other, sounds of people on the telephone, sounds of people working with the machine or some kind of inanimate objects. The sounds of people working together, the sounds of teams working together, doing the work that needs to be done, teaming. You know, the literature is very clear about teams, that the amount of communication correlates directly with quality. So from time to time, you may want to stop and practice this again, noticing if communication is free and flowing or somewhat restricted. Are members of the team feeling safe to speak? Perhaps reflecting on your own role, if you are observing a team you are part of, and how you can enhance that safety. I hope you found this podcast and the simple exercise useful to you, and look forward to having you join us for the next episode of Flourishing in Medicine from Surviving to Thriving. To learn more about MPRO and support programs, please visit www.mympro.com/peer-support. If you're a physician or a medical student and in need of urgent support, please consider calling the physician support line at 1-888-409-0141 or visiting www.physiciansupportline.com. For more information about me and my work, you can visit me at www.mickkrasnermd.com or www.mindfulpracticeinmedicine.com. Until next time.